This is Radio Free Thinker, episode 66.
Mars is the next logical step in our space program. It's the challenge that's been staring us in the face for the past 30 years.
It has water, it has carbon. It has a 24-hour day. It has geothermal energy. Mars is a place we can settle.
There is a giant rift in its surface. 5,000 kilometers long. There is a volcano as wide as Arizona.
So there's the choice in life. One either grows or one decays. Grow or die. I think we should grow.
Mars is a world of wonders.
It has canyons, river valleys, and giant ice sheets.
Mars is a world of wonders.
It shouldn't be humans to Mars in 50 years. It should be humans to Mars in 10. We either muster the courage to go, or we risk the possibility of stagnation cosmically.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science and philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist.
This is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers and economics student here at UBC.
And that we were just listening to is the latest song from the Symphony of Science people.
I really, really like that whole series. I mean, some of them are better, some of them are worse. What I was amazed to find out recently, because I went to their website when I heard that they had this this new one, is a whole bunch of people are doing remixes of them. I was ignorant. I didn't know that there's like 10 different remixes or of each one of the songs that someone else has taken their shot at.
They've really become quite popular. I was just saying to a friend of mine, actually, who's not really a skeptic, and they've heard these songs before. And it's quite remarkable when you think about it.
Auto-tuning has finally been put to good use.
And just because we do use it so much, if you go to their website, apparently he's selling a 7-inch single of some of this stuff. So,
Rob, don't you actually have one of the versions of his
yes,
songs?
Yes, actually, as a birthday present, my girlfriend got me one of the little 7-inch LPs that has etchings on one side that mirror what Sagan sent up with Apollo something or other.
And for all those who aren't DJs or of the older ilk, what's an LP again?
Vinyl record.
Vinyl record? How would that work?
You mean
that's an entire segment to itself.
Yeah. We should cover
it
that.
It spins and this thing vibrates.
We should cover audiophiles, actually, one of these days. There's a lot of stuff there to cover for a skeptic.
Exactly. Well, today we have a great show, and did you guys have a good week? I had a great week. How was your week?
Oh, I had a great week. I had a fantastic week. Friday night, Ethan and a bunch of the crew of the skeptic community in Vancouver got together, and we did a little bit of skepticism,
What is skepticism, Don?
Skepticism.
It's a silly portmanteau. I was going to say something else, but...
Yes, well, Rob's just been ejected from the show. No, skepticism. It's skeptic activism. It's the idea... We went to Deepak. Deepak had a show in Vancouver on Friday, and we wanted to do something, but what were we going to do? I mean, we didn't want to go there and protest, because it made it seem too... He's not that important, and we didn't want to annoy people who've been sucked in by this guy and the things that he said. But we wanted to go there, we wanted to educate people, we wanted to promote skepticism to him. So we were essentially being activists for the skeptic cause. And we went there and we had a great time. In fact, some of us had an even more special time. I remember sitting there and someone walked by me and said, I think I knew who that is. Suddenly, Ethan is waving and there's conversations going on. Ethan, who are you talking to?
Well, so to give some context, basically what we had was this flyer, right? And we encouraged people to think critically on this flyer. We had a few facts about Deepak and what he was saying. And for those of you who aren't familiar, the Queen Elizabeth Theater has basically two entrances. So we stood on either side of the entrance and we were handing out flyers as people walked in. And I looked over and I saw this sort of large entourage of people walk in. And I think Dawn and a few other of our volunteers were handing out flyers to them. And I'm like, that guy looks familiar. And they're walking towards the theater. They all stop suddenly, turn around and look at us, and I go, That's Deepak Chopra. We just handed him a flyer advising him to think critically about himself.
Well, and you know, we should always think critically of ourselves.
Exactly. That is the Skeptic Manifesto. So
how did he respond?
Well, he turned around and looked at us, and I kind of waved, and he sort of waved back, and then they walked over, so I went over and talked to them, and our two entourages met and cordially shook hands, and quite interesting enough, Deepak introduced one of his fellow people there.
You know, I hate to say this, but Deepak was such a nice guy. I mean, he was polite, he was conversational, but one of the members of his entourage was his pit bull, his bulldog.
Yeah, we sort of nicknamed his Deepak's bulldog. This guy, Stuart Hameroff, I guess Deepak seemed to think this guy offered him some legitimacy, because apparently he's a professor at the University of Arizona in the Department of Anatheology and Psychology. I don't know how that relates to physics, or quantum mechanics. But anyway, he promptly says to me, "Skeptics are chicken. They refuse to debate me," which of course made me kind of wonder, well, didn't Deepak just debate Michael Shermer and Sam Harris like a couple months ago?
Yeah, so was this Deepak who said that skeptics are chicken?
No, this was his bulldog, this Dr. Hameroff fellow.
Okay, I wasn't sure because I'd heard conflicting reports.
Deepak barely said two words. Well, he said about four words, really. He introduced Stuart Hameroff, which was basically the first thing he said to me. And I said, well, my name is Ethan, and I'm the executive director of CFI Vancouver, to which he replied, "I know who you are." I'm sure he meant he knew who CFI was, not me personally. I'd be honored if he knew who I was.
He's keeping tabs on you.
Yeah. He's watching us right now.
Not too accurate, because you're new to the job still.
Exactly. Anyway, so we had this really quick conversation. I think what will come out of this is that Deepak will be able to brag that he confronted some skeptics. We can brag that we confronted Deepak. That's pretty much as far as it's going to go.
I actually would really like to know if any one of our listeners went to the show, because he did. He kept kept our pamphlet, and if he's a showman, I think he is. He would have brought it up in his thing, because I mean, we gave pamphlets out to a lot of people that night.
We had over 300 pamphlets, and we gave them all away. The interesting thing about getting back to Deepak's bulldog, he did email me a couple days ago. And despite that he claims to be a university professor, and perhaps he is, his email was a little strange, I'll say that. Not quite consistent with what I usually expect from a university professor, and that university professors don't usually swear and use incorrect grammar.
Oh, please post this up on the blog.
Yes, well, anyway, aside from that one encounter, it actually went really, really well. There was no arguments. There were a few debates, but they were done in a very cordial manner. We did see some interesting celebrities. In fact, former mayor of Vancouver, Sam Sullivan, was there, and we handed him a flyer as well. And there was also some rather well-dressed people. There were some people dressed in various mystical, spiritual attire arriving. Looked sort of like ninjas. I wasn't quite sure.
Just locals from Kitsilano, probably.
Yeah, probably. One person quite humorously mentioned to me as I asked him if he was going to see Deepak, and he said yes. And I said, "Well, do you want a flyer?" And he said, "No, I already don't have high opinions of Deepak. In fact," he said, this is a quote, "Deepak makes Tiger Woods look like an altar boy." So it was quite successful. And again, people were quite friendly to us. I'm sure some people disagreed. One person crumpled up the flyer and gave it back to us, which was nice because he didn't litter, which is always important.
I remember reading on Ian Bushfield's blog, Communist Manifesto, he talked about this and mentioned that someone actually tore up the flyer before handing it back to them very disgustedly.
Yeah. I did notice that with a lot of people who are arriving in couples, one person would maybe take the flyer and go, "Oh, this is garbage." But the other person would be like, "Well, let me see that." I'd be quite enthused to see it. So perhaps somebody was getting dragged to this conference against their will.
I should probably just correct something. I believe our communist is Ian Cromwell, not Ian Bushfield.
Right.
Oh, sorry.
Ian Bushfield also has a very awesome blog as well. Anyway, so very successful. I was quite pleased with this. And in fact, it's gotten a bit of attention. Our good pal PZ Myers spoke very highly of this event over on his blog. And I think that...
Which is Pharyngula.
That's right. And I encourage, you know, any skeptic who is interested in this sort of activism should get in touch with us. We're happy to do it. And I also want to throw congratulations to everyone who did participate, because this was a great success.
Yeah, actually, I think skepticism is one of the things we can promote here. But Ethan, I'm curious because how many is Deepak Do people go out to his shows a lot to educate those people going into them? I mean, he seemed really kind of surprised as to what we were up to. There was a bit of... So, I mean, like, it's like, I can't believe this is the first time people have gone out there and tried to counter his woo.
I'm sure it happens because, actually, this idea sort of came up, sort of what Don was mentioning. We didn't want to protest. We didn't want to go out there with signs and angry chants. But I have heard of other groups doing very similar things. You guys are familiar with Sylvia Brown, I take it. Well, when she was in Ottawa, the Ottawa Skeptics handed out flyers entitled How to Be a Psychic Like Sylvia Brown. And people took them with gusto. And I'm sure that that went over a lot better than simply saying, you know, Sylvia Brown is a horrible, lying so-and-so. They took the pliers, they're going to read them, and they might learn something. And even if they throw them away, you know, at least they know that there's another opinion out there. And
actually, if for those of us who want to see the flyers, do you have them available online somewhere?
They are, in fact. If you go to CFI's webpage at www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver, it's listed under the event listing of the DPAC gathering. So I encourage you to check that out.
All right, we'll post a link to that in the show notes.
Exactly. Well, that was my weekend and Don's weekend. Anyone else have an amazing skeptical story to tell?
I basically spent yesterday celebrating Allison's birthday. We got a little drunk and played Rock Band. It's pretty awesome. Huh. But actually, on the subject of protesting woo, there was an interesting study that Discover magazine talked about and that I think SDU covered, but it sort of speaks to this, that it's a good idea that you didn't come with signs and protest it, and basically science rejects this outright, because according to this study, people are more likely to accept a supernatural claim if they believe that the scientific establishment rejects it outright, as opposed to when you just present people with information about the claims that are being made, that they'll be more likely to do the research themselves and come to their own conclusions.
So you're saying that science actually makes people more skeptical?
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
Well, I suspect, actually, this is one of those pendulum things. I was watching a show the other day on BBC about it went from farm to pharma, and how science at one point was seen as, you know, the way that we can save the world, and it's going to have all sorts of promise and all that. Then you had, like, the nuclear bomb and thalidomide, a few bad things. And then people said, well, maybe science isn't the savior of everything, and there's kind of this anti-science mood. So maybe this is just reflecting the swing of the social pendulum.
I think it could also be that people don't like being told what they should believe. They maybe if it's subtly done, they'll accept
Daniel,
it.
Daniel, stop that. You don't believe that.
But if someone just outright tells you you're wrong, even if you think they might be right, you're probably not going to want to listen to them because they're kind of jerks.
Interesting.
That actually leads into something that I was listening to again on Quirks and Quarks. It was a gentleman, what is his name again? Dr. Arley, Dan Arley.
Dan Arley.
Who's did a book called Predictably Irrational. It shows that actually lots of times we're not rational. I mean, as skeptics, we figure, well, if we just present the facts to these people, any rational individual would pick this because we did, right? And, well, the human brain doesn't really always act in a very rational way. And his point of this book and what he was trying to go with this is that although we act irrational, we tend to act irrational in predictable ways. And because there's some predictability in it, we can actually harness that to our own benefit.
Yeah, this is actually part of a large movement in research right now called behavioral economics, where researchers like Dana Reilly and others are looking at the way people make decisions and how often their decisions are not based on their own reasoning, but very highly influenced by outside factors that tend not to be rational at all.
And you know, when we come back after this commercial, I can tell you some very interesting experiments that he discusses in his talk at Quirks and Quarks.
All right, we'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back now. As I promised you before, we were talking about a book called Predictably Irrational by Dr. Dan Ariely, whose names I'm not really good at. So, but in his talk, he was talking about how people are irrational, that we think we're rational people, but we're not really rational. We tend to make irrational choices. One of the examples he uses is something called the prisoner's dilemma. Now, anyone who's acquainted with classical economics knows that in the prisoner's dilemma, you're given a choice where, in this particular case, he's changed a bit. I can give you $20. I can keep $5. If I give you $20, oh, crap, now I can't remember how it
goes.
Okay,
here, I'll do it. Okay, basically what there is there's two different prisoners in two different rooms being questioned by the police. Both of them are given the option to rat out the other person. If they rat out the other person and they don't rat them out, they get a year in prison. If they both rat out each other, they get 5 years in prison. But if you don't rat out the other person, but he rats out you, you get 10 years in prison. So no matter what the other person does, if neither rats each other out, then they both get no time in prison. But it doesn't, whatever the other person does, if they rat you out or they don't rat you out, you are better off ratting them out. Because you will get less time in prison under either of those cases. So rationally, you should always rat the other person out, no matter what they do.
But it turns out that because both people are being perfectly rational and deciding based on this, you know, utilitarian matrix to rat out the other person, both of them rat each other out, and both of them go to prison for longer than if either only one of them or none of them ratted each other out.
Now, of course, that's what rational choice theory, that's what it's supposed to be. But study after study after study have shown that actually people by nature are much more trusting and they're much more willing not to rat the other person out, going for the big prize because, you know, you just like that. And so that's one of the cases where, because we have this sense of altruism, the sense of trust, that we break the rational mode, but we tend to do so in a predictable way. He used another example, which I loved, which was called this, I don't know why he called it, the prisoner's dilemma with vengeance. But the idea is that if I have a mango and I leave the mango here and you like the mango, and I go away, you have the choice. You can take the mango and figure, well, I'll take the mango. We're on a tropical island. It's easy for you to get another mango. There's not going to be much risk about that. But if you knew that I was a psycho, that if you took my mango, I would hunt you down. I would kill you and your family's family. You wouldn't do it. And apparently it's this idea that it's not rational for me to be vengeful. I mean, the rational choice would be just to go grab another mango. But people, again, aren't always rational. We get this vengeful side in us. And it's the combination of this altruism and vengefulness that he's trying to play on in his book, is saying that people, don't you dare say anything, Daniel, or I'll get you.
Well, I would argue that it could be rational to be vengeful, because if you do that, he's unlikely to ever steal your mango again. But I see what your point is, and this example aside, yes, people aren't always rational.
Doesn't this sort of sync up with what we know about game theory? It's not the best way to survive game theory to go tit for tat. Isn't that sort of vengeance?
Well, actually, that's in a way, it's going against game theory, because game theory says, I can't win, so I'm going to go for number two spot, and everyone should go for number two spot because it offers the least worse outcome. So you're not going for the best outcome, you're going for the least worst outcome. That's really the essence behind game theory. And this says, if you base your beliefs on that, or if you base whatever system you're creating, it's going to fail because people aren't rational. They're either going to go for the best possible things, even though it's an irrational thing to do, or they're going to want you to have the worst case scenario just out of a sense of mean-spiritedness.
Interesting. Well, that's actually kind of scary, too.
Yeah, well, perhaps that explains why there's so many problems in the world today. on a similar note, I saw this study recently published in Psychological Science. It's research done by Dr. Damisch at the University of Cologne in Germany. And what they found is that superstitious rituals and lucky charms seem to actually give people an increase in performance on a variety of different tasks. Which sounds a little weird when you're like, why would a lucky charm actually make you do better at something. Clearly, there's no scientific reason to think that a lucky charm is going to have some, you know, magical benefit.
Well, it's probably along the same lines where people from, like women, if they're doing a test for math, if they're reminded at the start of the test that they're female and that females generally do worse on math tests, they do worse. It's because in your mind, with a lucky charm, at least if you believe in it, you feel like you're going to do better. And it's sort of the opposite of that last one where you feel like you're going to do worse.
A sort of priming effect. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that the researchers chose four really interesting and clever experiments to do this. The first of which was to have people try and sink a putt with a golf ball. And for some of them, they would give them a ball and say, this is the same ball that everyone else has been using. And for some of them, they would say, this ball has been particularly lucky today. And the people who were putting with the so-called lucky ball, which in fact had no difference from any of the other balls used in the study, would sink 35% more putts.
Is that significant?
It was statistically significant.
Well, you know, knock on wood, I hope I get that lucky ball next time I play golf.
In the second experiment, they had people doing one of those little physical mazes, like a cube with a little physical maze in it and those little silver balls. And then you have to get the balls to stay inside little nubbins inside the maze. The researchers, for some people, would say that they were crossing their fingers for them or hoping that they would do, you know, better in a sort of lucky ritual way. And the people who were in the condition where the researchers crossed their fingers for them took significantly less time to complete the maze. So it seems that these rituals and these lucky charms are having some effect on performance. So they wondered how this would work, and to hash it out, they had two more experiments, 3 and 4, where they basically looked at by which mechanism this could be working. And so in the third experiment, they had them do a memory game, and they told them to bring in a lucky charm that they thought was lucky from home. And for some of them, they let them have the lucky charm with them. And for some of them, they kept the lucky charm. They took it away from them and kept it in a different room. And by this, they were controlling for anxiety. So they had people measure how anxious they were to be separated from their favorite lucky charm. And when controlling for anxiety, found that the people who had the lucky charm performed better, regardless of whether they had separation anxiety from their personal object or not. So it's not the fact that the object had any personal significance to you that mattered. And so in the fourth experiment, they had people do a similar thing where they gave them a bunch of letters and they had to make as many different words out of those letters as possible. And the setup was the same. They told them to bring in a lucky charm from home. Some people, they let them have it. Some people, they kept it in a different room. Now, the crucial difference here was that the people that had the lucky charm with them persisted longer. They stayed with the task longer, and in doing so, found 50% more words than the other group, statistically significantly. So it seems that what's going on here is that having a lucky charm, like Daniel suggested at the beginning, increases your confidence. And the mechanism by which it's doing this, at least in one of these cases, is that your increased confidence will lead to increased persistence with the task. You think you're going to do better, so you stay longer with it, and just by being persistent, you end up doing better at it.
I wonder if this leads to some credence as to why people, like religions and religious icons. I mean, one of the big things in all forms of religion is the idea of a holy relic or some token that says, you know, I'm not alone or there's some higher power. And whether this is sort of the biological underpinning for this sort of thing.
It could be. I mean, I when I was reading this, I thought, well, there's so many, like you said, icons and religious symbols and rituals that people do that they do to prepare themselves for various important tasks in their lives. And maybe the reason they do it is because it gives them more confidence in doing it, and therefore they'll perform better.
Could this confidence be artificially created? I wonder if you said that people were given a ball that was they were told was lucky. So if you just tell somebody that something, a pen, for instance, is lucky, are they going to do better on a test? Or do they have to have a personal attachment to it? They have to feel it's their lucky thing.
I think if they believe it, if they believe that it could be lucky, it will work. I think one of the studies you mentioned, they actually did just tell people it was a lucky ball and it
worked. Yeah, based on the lucky ball experiment, where they had no previous experience with the ball, possibly some of them had never even played golf before, they just told them it was a lucky ball and they did better. That, coupled with the fourth experiment, where they measured anxiety from separation with a personal item and found that that had no effect. So the fact that it was a personal object didn't really matter.
There's actually two things, one serious, one not so serious. First of all, maybe the ball they gave really was lucky. But the second thing is did they filter out for people's credulity level? I mean, someone who believes in Lucky Charms, it would strike me it would have a stronger effect than someone who doesn't really believe in that sort of thing.
Don't recall from the study if they controlled for credulity in luck and ritual, but I'm assuming that they ran, you know, enough subjects that that would flatten out to some baseline level.
I'm sure they're saving that for their next research grant to do that kind of research. You identify the phenomena and then you work on it.
Well, I mean, it is interesting if you can replicate that effect. So if every time before you give a test to a class of students, if you all say, this test is really easy and you're all going to do fantastically, and that raises the general level of confidence, will they all perform better?
As opposed to all my professors who are always like, this is the hardest thing you will ever take. I'm like, thank you. That really raises my confidence.
Well,
level.
They're making sure that you fall within the department boundaries for the class average.
Yeah.
Actually, you brought up the pen earlier. There was a similar study that I saw this past week. I believe it was reported by Miller McCune, where they found that if they had people grade papers with a red pen, they were more harsh and gave people lower grades than if they had the same markers mark it with a blue pen.
So, wow.
So there's these kinds of environmental influences, just as simple as like the cultural significance associating a red pen with negative marking will have a significant effect on how you judge something.
Interesting. That's really interesting. Well, why don't we take a break and we'll be back with some more on
a lucky break.
Okay, fine, a lucky break. We'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker after this.
CITR loves its friends. Having a Friends of CITR card entitles you to awesome discounts from businesses in your community. Maybe downtown is your stomping ground. Present your CITR card at 212 Productions Limited, Beat Street Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, Hits Boutique, Dream Apparel and Articles for People, Scratch Records, The Fall Tattooing, Flaming Angel Designs, Spank Clothing, Heart and Soul, Pacific Cinema Tech, and True Value Vintage, and receive great discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
I wanna love you and treat you right.
Sam from the Go Team, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're going to be talking about democracy. Now, why on earth are we talking about democracy?
It does seem like an overly broad topic, but a few weeks ago we were talking about electoral reform, specifically with Britain, and we kind of got hung up on what exactly we want in democracies, what exactly a democracy should be. It wasn't so much of an argument over the type of systems that you can have and their individual merits and sort of the evidence behind what they would actually do, but it was, what should democracy be for us? What should democracy be aiming for?
In fact, actually, we were treating the subject almost as if, you know, everyone knew what democracy was. I mean, it was just democracy. Oh, we all know what that means. Almost in a sense of dogmatic concept of it. And I think, Daniel, when we were talking, the idea is, well, when we say democracy, what do we mean? Where does democracy come from?
Well, in my research, I decided to look up the origins a little. I'm sure pretty much everyone has heard of Greece being, ancient Greece being the sort of birth of modern democracy. But it probably goes a little farther back than that. Probably as long as humans have been getting together in tribes, we've had at least a small form of democracy, probably similar to the way you and your friends might order pizza, just sort of an informal vote to decide what you're going to do. Obviously, people back then didn't have recorded history, so this is hard to prove, and there is some debate amongst...
Scholars.
Scholars, yes. I was going to say their specific field, but...
Although that might explain the handprints. That might
anthropologists.
Have been the first form of voting was the handprints on the cave walls.
Maybe.
Or people drawing the, you know, I want this ox, and how many people are going with this ox? That's what the people around those little drawings are. They're not drawings of people. They're votes.
It could
but
very well
let's, be. Let's get back to what recorded history says.
Yeah, so starting in Athens, democracy... It came into its own, if you will. Athens had a direct democracy with probably more input by each individual person into governing than we have today. With that being said, though, this was only like 20-30% of the population because most of the population was slaves or women. But the people who could vote had lots of power. They were the direct... they were the direct power. It wasn't they sent representatives to the government or elected or appointed the government. They were the government.
It was even more extreme in the one sense that trials were done by democratic vote. You'd make your case here that I think Rob here is guilty of stealing my sheep, and Rob would say, no, I didn't steal his sheep. Someone else took your sheep. And then we'd literally have a vote on whether he did it or not, and that would be binding. So the concept of democracy in ancient Athens was for those who were allowed to have it, and we were talking 500, couple thousand at best, but it was very absolute democracy when they had it.
So even at the very beginning, democracy was devoid of basis on evidentiary reasoning. But more on that later.
Yeah, some of the trials had over 2,000 jurors on them. These are just the regular voting people. I'm not going to go too much into these, so I'll skip ahead a little bit to the Roman Republic. Rome decided to do things a little differently. They had a Senate, which was largely controlled by the rich, property-owning aristocracy, if you will. But there were also assemblies that were a direct link to, once again, male citizens. Not nearly everyone, but enough people... They had some power, but here's sort of where they first discovered one major problem with direct democracy. How do you get people who live over large geographic areas to come together and vote on these things?
Well, and there's another thing, too. In Athens and in the Roman Republic period, in times of crisis, war, that type of thing, they would actually elect a tyrant. And this is, we think of tyrants these days as very bad, negative things. But in those days, the idea of a tyrant was someone who would take command of the army, take command of society, and say, okay, we need to do this. We need someone in charge. And they would literally give up their quote-unquote democratic power to this tyrant for a set period of time. You know, and so... That also was sort of the starting the breakdown of this pure democracy.
Although that wasn't always a great idea for fans of history of the Roman Republic. There are some tyrants who didn't exactly want to give up that power at the end.
Exactly, but it raises an interesting question. If in modern day we basically elected someone, let's say we elected Stephen Harper to be a totalitarian leader for 4 years, and then when his 4 years were done, we'd elect a new person, is it still a democracy?
Well, I mean, isn't that the same kind of question as Hitler was democratically elected, was he not?
The difference there would be he got rid of all ways to take him out of power.
Well,
which is what tyrants tend to do.
Yeah.
And I think actually that's an important part to the story, because after we've had the Roman Empire and we've had the Dark Ages, then we start coming back to democracy as we kind of think about it. We had the first forms of parliament, which is really a form of aristocracy or oligopolies, but there were limits suddenly put on the king, a famous document being the Magna Carta.
Yes, the Magna Carta, I believe, 13th century history buff, correct?
Something like that.
It's 13th century.
The thing is, those ideas were floating around all over Europe. I mean, not every nation, because not all of them were nations, but a lot of them were operating under a semi-democratic process, like Venice, for instance, or the Netherlands and various other places.
Mm-hmm. I'm not saying the Magna Carta was the first, but it was sort of the first very well-codified limit on a monarch's power.
I think, too, the Magna Carta is iconic. So even though the idea, it's like the idea of evolution, right? Darwin came up with his theory of evolution, but the idea was kicking around, but it became iconic when you think of it in that context. The Magna Carta is an iconic imagery, but doesn't necessarily mean only the British invented it.
Yeah. Far from it, actually.
Yes. And then from that point on, not specifically because of that, but from that point on, for quite a while, the major form of democracy the world had, on a larger scale at least, was representative democracy. In the UK, it would be the Parliament, and your representative for the Parliament would go argue for what your geographic area would want, your interests.
I would interrupt. I think one of the things, when you deal with the age of the Magna Carta, you almost, again, had a form of direct democracy, except, of course, the only important people then were lords, barons, and all that. But you had an evolution where the electorate began to grow, where the number of people who were allowed to vote grew. And as that number became unmanageable, like in the Roman areas, it wasn't so much population as area. In England, it became number of people, and, of course, just not uniquely England. So then you had the ideas that, well, not everyone can go to London and run the government, so we will elect Bob, who will go and represent us in that. And the number of people who would vote for Bob became larger and larger and larger as the centuries rolled on.
Exactly. Until nowadays, where most countries, the number of people per representative is well over 10,000, if not hundreds of thousands in most places. Now, throughout until quite recently, actually, in the scheme of human history, if there was a democracy, it was extremely limited in who could actually vote. It was largely property-owning males until about the 19th century, when that was expanded to more males, pretty much everyone over the age of 18. Then it was expanded to women, largely in the early 20th century, I'd say. And
other minorities as well.
And not to mention the abolishment of slavery in much of the world around that time as well.
Right.
So until then, democracy, it was really the rule. It wasn't the rule of the people. It was the rule of a very specific subset of people.
Which, of course, is ironic because we've kind of gone full circle. And although we all vote for a representative, that political class now has kind of become in itself a small elite of forms. Or at least that's one of the complaints we have about democracy. But of course, that leads me to wonder, then, what exactly is democracy in the modern sense? What are the precepts, the fundamental elements of what we think of as democracy?
Well, when I was looking, researching this, I found an interesting article on democracy in the Encyclopedia Britannica, which will be linked. And it mentioned five basic questions that democracies need to answer. And I think it's a great way of classifying them. It's not everything, but it encompasses a lot of things, a lot of differences. I'll start with the first one, because that makes sense. The first one is, what is the appropriate unit or association within which a democratic government should be established? So, using Canada, for example, there's the federal government, so that's all of Canada. Then there's provincial or territorial governments, which are smaller but still large regions. And then each town or city has their own government. Well, a lot of towns or city have their own governments.
And actually, and that's usually how we think of traditional democracies, but even that sort of area can be divided up in different ways. If you're an anarcho-syndicalist communist, right, you believe that, like, workers, you know, of a factory can form their own sort of democracy for the workplace, or in different types of people. I mean, one of the things we have in this country is we have Aboriginal government, which is really essentially based on not where you are, but on who you are. And there's different ways. School boards, for example, right? Who gets to vote for school boards is largely limited to parents, although actually that might not be 100% true.
Well, I'm pretty sure anyone in a town gets to vote on the school boards, but even something like the AMS, the school government here at UBC sort of fits into this. They're sort of democratically elected. There was a few issues with the last election, but other than that, they're democratically elected by the people of the school. We don't necessarily all live on the school, so it's not really a geographic area. It's our belonging to the school.
So in this area, then, what do you guys all think? Do you think we should have democracy in every aspect, or is the traditional breakdowns pretty good? Like, should we only vote for city council or provinces, or should we, you know, I mean, should we all, we're all radio show personalities. Should we have our own democracy to control our particular aspects of life?
Well, I mean, it depends on how far we extend the goals of democracy. For example, you know, I happen to enjoy Coca-Cola, but I don't vote on the board of governors of Coca-Cola.
Daniel would say you do because your dollars are your votes.
Oh, that's an interesting way of looking at things.
Or if you're a shareholder, you probably technically could vote on some things. But
right.
But yeah, I think for me, the line is drawn depending on how voluntary your association with them is. So if you're in a country, it's not incredibly voluntary. You can't just leave the country, really. Others have to accept you in. I mean, you could go float out in the ocean, but that wouldn't be very good. So it's something you're born into or you move into, and it's hard to enter or exit. Same, this breaks down maybe a little bit with cities or towns, as they're fairly easy to enter and leave. But, I mean, you do have a home. It's hard to move. It takes time. Whereas something like buying a Coke, you could buy Pepsi instead. It's a very voluntary transaction.
Right.
So democracies have to decide, you know, who counts and how you divide people up into voting units or democratic units. What other questions do democracies have to answer?
Well, number two on this list is who should be a citizen. Largely, most Western democratic countries now fall in with roughly everyone over 18 should deserve a vote. It wasn't always this way, as we went into earlier, and I think most people roughly agree with this, except some racists or something. But
well, I'm surprised you used the word racist. I wasn't actually going to use that term. But, I mean, one of the big things that's rocking Europe right now, and often overlaps with the area of atheism, another AM is, you know, if you're a productive member of society, but you happen to be an immigrant, legal or illegal, do you have a right to vote in that country? And that's another area where, you know, the who gets to vote has a huge influence on how things are. If you happen to be in a country, let's say like Holland, and immigrants aren't allowed to vote, and you have a very xenophobic or racist domestic population, then, you know, how does that affect democracy?
There are also people who argue that only people who pay taxes should be able to vote, because in essence they are voting on what their money is being used for. We're not going to get into this argument fully, but it's an interesting question that has to be answered by a democracy. Simply saying something is a democracy doesn't answer this question. The third one they had was, how are the citizens to govern? What are the institutions and organizations? So, briefly, Canada has a parliament, and then within that parliament, an executive is formed from the leading party. There's also the federal system, where the provinces have separate governing structures. They're not subjugated to the federal level. And when you simply define something as a democracy, it doesn't answer any of these questions. I know I'm sort of beating a dead horse here, but fundamentally, there's so many different ways you could structure something that would loosely be considered a democracy.
Well, you know, let's assume we have our political institutions. I think another interesting thing, and moving on to your step four, is we assume we have a democracy. We assume we have people who vote. Well, you know, what if people are divided on an issue? How do we determine who gets to rule?
Well, why don't we take a break, recharge our batteries, and answer that question when we come back on Radio Free Thinker.
What might one hear when listening to an episode of Mondo Trash Show with Maxwell Maxwell on CITR 101.9 FM?
I love you so much, Madonna.
Sundays at 9 o'clock in the evening.
And that's why I'm going to kill you.
Sundays at 9 o'clock in the evening.
Roswell Green. Oh, God, it's so beautiful.
Hey, I'm Maxwell Maxwell, and every Sunday at 9 p.m. on CITR, I play electro and indie rock, and I give away free concert tickets, and you should totally listen, because it's pretty cool.
The 33rd Annual Vancouver Folk Music Festival, from July 16th to the 18th, brings a diverse lineup of artists from over 20 countries. Be sure to pick up your early bird passes by June 11th and save yourself money. Vancouver Folk Music Festival, July 16th to the 18th at Jericho Beach Park.
Tickets are available at www.thefestival.bc.ca, the box office at 438 Richard Street, and at Highlight, Zulu, Little Sisters Bookstore, and Banyan Books. For more information, visit thefestival.bc.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker talking about democracy. So we left off with some big questions hanging there. So what are the answers to these big questions?
Well, just to remind our viewers, the big question was, when there's a dispute over what should be done, who is to prevail? Should it be the majority? And if you decide the majority of what? The majority of voters? The majority of all people? The majority of some specific invested interests? These are all questions that a system has to answer.
Not to mention, how do you define a majority? 50% plus one, or does it have to be two-thirds?
Exactly. The constitutions often seek to handle this question. For instance, in the U.S., in order for something to be passed, it has to pass two houses of Congress, as well as get the president's signature and pass the Supreme Court of review. So, well, it could be subject to a review. So there's protection in there for minority interests who aren't necessarily enough of people in the House of Representatives or in the Senate to stop it, but there's still ways that they could modify or change laws being passed.
There's also the voters themselves can reject it as well, as voters here in BC have been trying to do with the HST.
Exactly. Some democracies have recall methods where voters themselves can recall laws or recall politicians.
And of course, that also leads into the idea is when our politicians, right, what's their role to do in a democracy? Do they represent strictly the will of the constituents that they are? Or do we vote for them like a proxy, says, I trust you, you vote whatever you think is right, and I believe in you? Or, you know, do we leave it to direct democracies we're trying to do with the referendums and that type of thing?
I think we're going to slowly segue into the Canadian system. But in Canada, it's sort of a mixture of a bunch of different things. We don't elect a representative purely to go do whatever they want in that they think is in our best interest, but we also don't elect them purely to represent the views of our area. We elect them knowing that they have their own views ahead of time.
So let's cut to the chase here. We've got a great explanation of you know, democracy and kind of roughly how it is, but why is democracy better than something like autocracy, meritocracy, or just plain old benevolent dictatorship, something I've always liked to do as long as it's me in charge?
Well, I think the fundamental problem with almost every other form of government is whoever has power to rule has no way of being stopped other than violence or bloodshed. Not in every case, but it seems to be in most cases.
Well, I mean, I think that there are also some historic views that you can make, and I'm not necessarily these are the accepted historic views, they're sort of my historic views, but I think that with a lot of democracies, how they arrive, they don't necessarily arrive out of sort of an egalitarian sense of let's do the right thing. They arrive because something bad has happened and they want to prevent that. You know, for example, the American Revolution was a rejection of a monarch passing taxes in a far-off land. The Dutch Revolution was a rejection of another government sort of sidestepping and ignoring Dutch customs and policies. You know, the British Magna Carta battle, the frequent civil wars were a result of different specific objections that were going on in that state, same with the French Revolution. So I think that in many cases, from a historic point of view, democracy is designed not so much to do something, but to prevent something else from happening.
One thing that's always, I guess, bothered me about democracy is precisely this, that like the people have almost too much control over things. Not to say that like I'm in favor of tyranny or despotism or whatever, but the idea that the people know what's good for them or indeed what they're talking about at all. So imagine, if you will, voting on the sex of a rabbit, as in the first season of Penn and Teller's BS, they describe the situation where you have people voting on the sex of a rabbit, and really what the people are voting about doesn't matter. You can actually check, you can find out. So there are a lot of, it seems to me at least, policy issues that are decided by vote, when really they should be decided by people who actually look into the issue and find out what's going on and actually know something about it. So I guess what I'm asking here is specifically speaking to meritocracy. You know?
Actually, you know, and you're bringing up probably the most consistent complaint with democracy. Again, as almost dogma, everyone says we love democracy, we want democracy, democracy is really, really good. But in order to have a true democracy, you need an informed and engaged populace. And in the absence of that, which goes to your thing, is the meritocracy. I mean, who's our prime minister? Well, okay, he was an economics major, right? Doctor. I think he's got a doctorate in economics, right? Which is good if he was a finance minister. But, I mean, does that make him the best person to run this country? And how many politicians are elected just because they're popular and not because they actually know what they're doing?
On that point, though, my biggest problem with meritocracy is who decides who has merit? Especially for positions like prime minister, what is a prime minister supposed to know? What is he supposed to be good at? It's not a simple question to answer. Now, you could easily say, well, let's say environmental policy. We should have a mixture of people who, scientists who know what's going on with the environment, as well as economists or behavioral economists or psychologists who know ways to make humans treat the environment better. But there's a lot of positions where it's not that simple. And it's also missing the point of ultimately who's deciding what the government should get involved with in the first place.
Well, and I guess to answer your first question, those kind of decisions are made every day at universities across the country. I mean, every department has faculty members and they have heads of departments that aren't democratically elected. They're elected by quote-unquote people in the know for their particular area. So I don't think that's quite the hurdle that you make it out to sound to be. And I think the second thing is sure, maybe you do need a minister of PR to check the voice of it. But now you're leading to another major problem with democracies, is quite frankly, most people don't care or don't want to be involved. I mean, you look at the number of people who are involved in politics during elections. Barely 50% actually vote. Between elections, how many people besides the really wonky out there really even care, do anything politically in between?
Well, if people start, you know, campaigning about an issue that basically lets them focus all of their energies and all of their irritations at, you know, the perceived failings of the government or particularly one person in the government. I'm speaking here, of course, of Bill Van der Zelm's big anti-HST petition, which is sort of like a focusing point for everyone who's fed up with Gordon Campbell or the BC Liberals. And it turns into a sort of, I guess, you know, spectacle. It's getting people involved in politics, not because they actually know anything about politics or because they want to do anything about it. It's because they're fed up with democracy in general.
Exactly. I'd make the argument that, and not to sound too libertarian here, but the point stands no matter what, is that the government is just too big for any one person to understand what's going on all across it. And just this is just the federal government. It's different if you add in provinces and municipalities that people live in. But there are over 3,424 regulation bills, whatever they're called, with many, many more parts in each one of them, and over 690 statutes with hundreds of secondary parts in all those. Plus, there's international treaties we sign, plus everything the government gets to decide to do outside of written law. And there's no way anyone could even conceivably know a tenth of what is going on.
I think also getting back to what Don just mentioned with voter apathy and apathy of participating in government, which was Daniel's getting at, I think part of the problem is our government is stable. If all four of us never voted again, we probably wouldn't see a revolution in our lifetime. You know, if the Liberals became the ruling party in Canada, society would not change. If the NDP became the ruling party, society would probably not change. You might pay a little bit more, a little bit less on your taxes. But you're not going to see a violent revolution in terms of your lifestyle. You're not going to have to give back your car. You're not going to have to start wearing a funny hat. It's just going to stay relatively the same. And people don't see that as an important factor. They don't look and go, wow, if I don't vote, so what? I pay a bit more taxes. I pay a bit less taxes. Who cares? And they don't see government as doing anything revolutionary anymore. They don't see Canada having to vote on, should we go to war with France? You know, we don't anticipate this coming up. And therefore, you know, we don't care if the government signs a treaty with France because we don't expect us to go to war with France.
Which is unfortunate because there's so many things, I mean...
That France has that we should take?
Well, no, to bring up a serious point, this tabling of the new Canadian copyright bill, Bill C-23 or some version of C-61 that adds in provisions for making it illegal to break DRM, for example. These things that have huge implications for a wide, wide population, but no one cares. So it seems that one of the possible problems with democracy is how do you deal with an apathetic voting populace?
Well, actually, you know, Ethan was just saying actually shows one of the successes of the dogmatic following of democracy is the fact that it's very good for maintaining the status quo. Whoever the elites are, however you define them, whoever's in charge, because we've just said that most people don't really vote, don't really care. Someone's making those decisions. It seems to be a very effective way to maintain the system. And in fact, if you sit there and you try and criticize democracy, most times people say, listen, if you don't have democracy, you're either going to have Hitler or Stalin, so sit down and shut up once every 4 years, and that's the end of it. And I mean, there are other alternatives. I mean, Daniel often talks about people power and how we need to have more individuals. I don't think that works for the majority of things, but that doesn't mean it can't have some aspects in our life. You know, it's just, and you mentioned, you know, war in France. Well, I hate to remind you, but we are in a war. It's called Afghanistan, and, you know.
Is that technically a war, though?
Well, people are dying, bombs are being shot, so you could say it's like the Korean War, where it was actually a police action.
A war
action.
That's not really a war.
Yeah, you know, but you know, there are things.
It's a political problem.
And,
yeah.
And let's go back to another thing that Rob had said about, you know, people get really, really upset about the HST. You know, people did. People got, and I can't pull the Goldman rule, so I'll come up with another example. People might vote against the HST, and at the same time, the people who are against HST are also in favor of slavery of yellow people or purple people or something, right? So you're all hot and bothered about HST, and you vote out the people who are for HST and vote in the people against HST, but they might be in favor of a whole bunch of other stuff that either you don't care about or you're so wrapped up in this. This happens in the United States with the Republican Party. They get wrapped up, worried about Bibles in schools and gay marriage, and they vote in people who are going to cut their services and raise their taxes, and there's this disconnect that often happens.
Speaking to this issue of a disconnect between the populace and the democracy, a lot of it comes down to allegations of corruption. Democracies are often considered to have sort of institutionalized, very easily hideable corruption within their systems because of so many, you know, slippery issues as how exactly you define a democracy and how exactly you define what the government is supposed to do and how the people are allowed to have a say in what it does. So I actually found a study on this by researchers called Morris and Klensner in Comparative Political Studies. They used this thing called the America's Barometer Study, which was a massive, large-scale demographic study that also included interviews with individuals done in 2004. And they used part of it where it was called the Latin American Public Opinion Project, where they looked at over 1,500 Mexicans, 18 and over, about their opinions about, among other things, the government and what they do about it and corruption within it. And what they found was that even a perception of corruption within the government, based on even one small scandal, for example, the liberal sponsorship scandal, will lead to the populace having little to no trust in the government. which leads to voter apathy, no attempt to cooperate with the government to remove the corruption, which leads to more corruption because people think everyone is doing it, so people are more likely to do it themselves, and it's this spreading problem of corruption based on a disconnect between the populace and the government.
Rob, I'll give you $5 if you bury that report.
Just because we're running out of time here, there's a lot more we could talk about, so I'll try and post it on the blog, maybe write a longer blog post about it, or we'll do something, because there's a lot more to talk about, but we have to wrap up.
Right. Well, let's go on to our skeptical highlights. I have a great one. On Saturday the 12th at 11 a.m., we have our monthly cafe inquiry. And this cafe will be about religious symbols, things like God and the Anthem and religious symbols in other parts of society. So I encourage you to come out. That's the 12th at 11 a.m. at SFU Harbor Center. It's going to be in room 1600. Then later in the month, speaking of politics, we have the first openly atheist politician in Canada giving a talk for us called Science and Medicine Under Attack, Why Religion and Politics is Dangerous. That's Friday the 25th at 7 p.m. at SFU Harbor Center in room 1600. Sounds pretty fun to me.
I have actually a skeptic low light. I've been listening to my science shows, whatever, and a new movie apparently has just come out called Splice, which apparently is one of these things about where they're mixing the human genome and animal genome together, creating some horrible monster. Everything I've heard is that this makes 2012 look like a decent documentary. That this is supposed to be such a horrible misuse of science. So just letting
probably
people
not as horrible as the B movie horror movie, The Human Centipede.
Oh. that
for
was,
those of you who've heard of it.
That was real, wasn't it?
Just don't watch the trailer.
So for my skeptical highlight, Fred Bremer, a friend of skepticism in Vancouver and Skeptics' number one fanboy, has been promoting a Facebook event. It's happening at the Vancouver Public Library tomorrow, Wednesday, at 6 p.m. Someone will have to correct me on that. But it's basically this fellow who just recently published a book, and he's going to give a talk about how to interpret statistics and when you should trust them and when you should not trust them.
All right, Daniel, anything coming up?
I was going to say that if you didn't, so that's all I had.
All right, then. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying, vote Don.
This is Rob saying, have a good evening.
This is Daniel saying, thanks for listening.